Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Brad Lancaster. He is the author of the book Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands, and his website is harvestingrainwater.com. He will be in Santa Fe for the Bioneers Conference, which takes place starting on the 19th of October. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Your specialty is rainwater harvesting. How much rain can one harvest in a desert climate like northern New Mexico or where you live, Arizona, compared to how much water you actually need?
Well, that all depends on the size of your catchment, be it a roof or the property, and what your needs are. But there's actually quite an abundance of rainwater compared to the perceived scarcity. I'll give you one interesting statistic there. In my community of Tucson, Arizona, the average Tucsonan uses 165 gallons of water per person per day. And we're importing the Colorado River water, we're depleting our groundwater tables, and looking to bring in yet still more sources of water because we think we don't have enough local water. But if you look at how much rain falls on Tucson in an average year of rainfall, you find that there's more rain falling on the surface area of Tucson than we are currently consuming of municipal supplies. In fact, if you were to do the math of the surface area of Tucson divided by the population, and 365 days a year, you find there's 235 gallons of rainwater per person per day.
Yeah, that would be if you could put a giant roof over the city and none of it would evaporate, you could have more than enough water.
Right, right. And so what that statistic says, I'm not trying to say we should only be using rainwater to get our water, but what that statistic says to me is there's this huge volume of water that we currently just drain out of the system, and we could instead be harvesting it and utilizing it. We don't need to capture every drop, but we certainly need to start harvesting some of it.
So how do you do that? How does rainwater harvesting actually work? Let's start with a residential. I own, a little house. How do I harvest rainwater?
Well, you've got a number of options. And the two most basic is you can either store water in a tank or a cistern, or you could store the water in the soil and then use the vegetation as your pumps to get it back out. So if you're wanting to use water for drinking, washing, bathing, or just to have readily at hand to irrigate a garden or whatnot, the cistern is definitely, or the water tank is definitely the way to go. But if you are just wanting to irrigate low water use plantings, particularly native perennials, then the way to go is not a tank, but instead to create bowl-like shapes within the soil of your yard so these shapes capture and infiltrate water rather than allowing it to run off, and then utilizing those native low-water use plantings as the living pumps that bring the water back out.
What do you mean by that living pump?
Well, plants naturally draw water up into themselves and then evapotranspire the water back out into the air through their leaves. So they're a great living pump or living mechanism that's always drawing water up into them and then back out into the atmosphere. So if we're going to store water in the soil, oftentimes people, when they hear that idea, they think, the water's gone, how do I get it back out? Well, if you've got a network of roots going throughout that soil, the plants will then uptake it. So you can enjoy that water that you harvested in the soil now in the form of cooling shade, a windbreak, fruit, wildlife habitat, and so on.
You, in your house where you live in Tucson on, I believe you wrote, a quarter-acre lot, harvest 100,000 gallons of rainwater a year. That's 273.9 gallons a day, if I calculated right. That's huge. What do you do with that water? How do you use it?
Well, and actually it's even more impressive. It's just an eighth of an acre. site. The way we harvest the water and the way we use it is we primarily use these water harvesting earthworks of bowl-like shape basins in the flat parts of the yard, contour berms on the slope part of the yard. And then by selecting low water use vegetation, we found that once established, that all those plants, and many of them food producers, don't need any supplemental irrigation. They get by entirely with harvested rainwater. And then we
So that's simply based on how you dig the shape of the dirt in the yard?
Yeah, yeah. And then you mulch the surface of the soil. And the reason you mulch the surface of the soil, you know, leaves and straw, whatnot, is so it's a spongier, more porous welcome mat that infiltrates the water more quickly, and it also reduces water loss to evaporation.
And you just mulch it with stuff from your compost, let's say, or what do you, how do you mulch it?
Yeah, the compost is great, but you can use any organic matter. I mean, we actually even use junk mail. We put the junk mail down on top of the soil, and we don't want to look at the junk mail. So on top of the junk mail, we put straw, bark, compost, H manure, you know, or a combination of all those things.
Junk mail, isn't it bad for you?
Well, it's certainly bad for your mailbox, but we haven't had any problem putting it out into the landscape in the garden.
That's hilarious.
The primary irrigator of our landscape and our garden is rainwater. The secondary irrigator of our landscape is gray water. Now, gray water is the water from any household drain except the toilet, the kitchen sink, or the dishwasher. So,
what does that leave?
That leaves your showers, your bathtub, your washing machine, reverse osmosis water filters, bathroom sink. So all of those we send out into the landscape. So that drain water, that gray water, becomes a secondary water source that's there when we have no rain.
So but you're getting your shampoo and body suds water.
Yes.
And your washing machine water. Do you have to use special products?
Yeah, that's a great question. You do want to be careful what soaps you use. And the most basic thing to keep in mind is do not use bar soaps and do not use powdered detergents or soaps because those are very high in salt, which is bad for our salty alkaline soil.
Hmm.
Because, you see, the more salt you add to the soil, the harder it is for plants to uptake the water and the harder it is for plants to photosynthesize.
And all bar soaps are salty?
Just about, yeah, because most of the bar soaps are using a lye as the base material, which is very alkaline.
Does that include glycerin soaps?
Now, if the glycerin soaps are not using lye, you can be okay.
Interesting.
Just as a general rule, it's best to use liquid soaps and liquid detergents. And on my website, harvestingrainwater.com, I actually have a whole page dedicated to gray water harvesting. And there, it gives extensive information on what soaps are good to use, what are bad to use. So you also don't want to use any chlorine-based bleach. You can use hydrogen peroxide-based bleach, but do away with the chlorine.
So all of this water that comes out of your washing machine and your shower and bathroom and so on, bathroom sink, goes into, again, how do you use it? Does it go straight into the landscape? Does it go into a tank? Is it a different tank than your rainwater?
Yeah, great question. We never send our gray water to a tank. The gray water always goes immediately into the root zone of the soil within these rainwater harvesting basins. So the basins, these earthworks, they harvest both rainwater and gray water. The reason we don't store gray water is it's high in organic matter from the soaps and our skin and stuff. So there's a lot of food for bacteria in it. And if you store it in a tank, the bacteria populations skyrocket.
So it'll get nasty within hours.
Yeah, it starts to smell. But if you send that gray water directly to the soil, it's not a problem because the soil microbes immediately start to digest both the organic matter and the bacteria. So it's the natural filter.
What happens in the winter when it's freezing outside? You live in a climate like Santa Fe, and sometimes in the winter it's 5 degrees outside. You take a shower, your water goes. Do you have an ice rink in your earthworks there?
Another great question. So, you're going to be directing this water below the mulch layer. So that can reduce, at least in the beginning and the end of the winter season, you know, you won't have any freezing problems. Another option is you can send this gray water completely subsurface into an infiltration chamber, which is basically this bottomless plastic chamber that lets the water infiltrate right into the soil, but you can cover it so you don't see it. The other key thing is what I like to do with all gray water harvesting installations is I have a valve that allows me to send the gray water to the landscape or the sewer or septic. So if my soils are super saturated with water, or it's very cold and the soils are frozen, or let's say I'm sending something bad down the drain, I can just switch that valve, so instead of sending it to the landscape, it goes to the sewer or the septic.
What do you mean by something bad, like
chlorine.
Turpentine? Oh, okay.
Yeah, turpentine too, or chlorine bleach.
We're talking to Brad Lancaster. He's the author of Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands, and his website is harvestingrainwater.com. How much capital does it require to make all of this work? I'm sure that there's so many Santa Feans who own a little house with a yard and are ecologically conscious in the sense that they want to make the city a better place and make their lives better and save money and so on. It seems like is this something that can be done by the sweat of one's own brow? Is it a big capital expenditure if you want to start using rainwater and gray water?
It doesn't have to be at all. It can be very inexpensive. All depends on how you do it. If you're just sending the water to these earthworks, there's nothing to buy except a shovel. And you just move the soil around and then either seed or purchase the appropriate plantings. If you want a rainwater tank, that's going to be more expensive, and again, that just depends on the size of the tank. But the general cost of a rainwater tank is $1 a gallon of storage. I find that with either strategy, it really pays off because you're getting the best quality water when you use rainwater, because rainwater is naturally distilled, it has no salts in it, and it's a natural fertilizer. When we have our electrical storms with the thunder and lightning, it actually takes atmospheric nitrogen and, due to the electrical storm, converts it into a form plants can use, and the raindrops bring that on down. The other great thing is by harvesting this rainwater and whatnot, you start to become independent of the fluctuations of the municipal supply, while at the same time benefiting the community watershed, because you're starting to put water into the system rather than just taking it out as you would with the pumps at the municipal system and whatnot.
Well, you've talked about actually raising the level of the water in local wells.
Yeah. Now, we haven't done it in Tucson yet because we don't have enough critical mass. But there's numerous stories, many of which I feature in my two books. One example I'll give you is in southeastern Arizona, a ranching family, the Austins. They have El Coronado Ranch and in the Cochise Mountains, or foothills of the Cochise Mountains. They put in 20,000 low loose rock check dams in all the drainages on 2,000 acres of their ranch. And these were just to slow the flow of the water coming down. It didn't stop the flow. It just slowed it down so it had more time to infiltrate the soil. And after they did this work, they found that their well levels rose, those of all their immediate neighbors rose, and they turned two drainages that would only run for few months out of the year, they changed it so now they run year-round. And they're not getting any more rain than they used to. The only difference is they're slowing down the speed by which the water flows through the landscape.
And the main technique for that was, as you say, a shovel?
Well, a shovel and a pry bar, just moving some rocks and making these low, porous walls across the drainages that just slow the flow down. So if you have a soil, yard just full of soil, you're using the shovel and just digging basins and whatnot, or contour berms. all these strategies, all these earthworks, they're just speed humps in the flow of runoff. So you're basically asking the water to walk through your yard and neighborhood instead of speeding through.
And when it walks through, it penetrates the soil more slowly instead of running across it, evaporating, or just going down a drain.
Exactly. And too often we think of stormwater as a problem and or a liability. And that's because all too often we send the water from our roofs, our yards, our city parks and commercial properties into the street where we have flooding problems and where it is a liability. But if instead we started to infiltrate that water on our home landscapes, in our schoolyards, in our commercial landscapes and whatnot, and alongside our streets, not within our streets, we could dramatically shift things around because we would have a system of infiltrating water, not runoff. And infiltrating water, it moves slowly, it's not erosive, it's productive, it feeds our wells, feeds our groundwater table, improves water quality. So it's a much better system.
So this is something, as you just alluded to, is possible not only for people's houses, but for schools and businesses and so on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you seen it actually people doing that in commercial and public buildings?
Yeah, in Austin, Texas, a lot of big box stores are now harvesting the water off their roofs to provide the water for the restroom toilets to irrigate the whole landscape. Walmart, believe it or not, is starting to do this as well. And beyond. And in Los Angeles, California, they have now realized the insanity of, okay, well, what they used to do is they were spending $1 billion a year importing water, and then they spent millions more draining out $500 million worth of stormwater.
Oh, my goodness.
So the water department was fighting the stormwater department. So now they started to join forces, and they're taking money out of the storm control or the flood control budget to help pay for the creation of these water harvesting strategies in schools. So instead of creating concrete-clad stormwater infrastructure at the bottom of the city, they're now creating these water harvesting strategies throughout the city, starting at the top of the watershed and working all the way down. So many of the schools are doing this. They're subsidizing the work in businesses and private homes and along the streets. Here's another little juicy thing. In Tucson, we found that the average residential street, just the street, was draining 1 million gallons of runoff per mile. Okay? That's just the rain.
That's a lot of runoff.
Yeah. And if you do the calculations, you find that that is enough water to support over 400 trees per mile or one tree every 25 feet on both sides of the street if you were to direct the street runoff into street-side water harvesting basins, which is very easy to do. And we've started to do it in Tucson. They're doing it in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Los Angeles, California. So all of a sudden, our stormwater control system can become the free irrigation source for our street trees. The street becomes the irrigator for the street trees. And we reduce the heat island effect and instead create the cool island effect because we have shaded streets, not exposed hot solar oven streets.
So all of this is possible. The only barrier is not so much money, but knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the information, it's all out there. We just need to start applying it so that more and more of us can see through direct experience, oh, this is how you do it. This is how it works. There's examples throughout the world. We just need to get more of them out there.
Now, what are some of the rules turning back to gray water systems? Do they vary from one community to the next? Can anybody just decide, I'm going to install a gray water system?
Yeah. Arizona and New Mexico lead the nation in the progressive gray water laws. So throughout Arizona and New Mexico, it is legal to harvest household gray water. You don't even need a permit. In fact, if you just follow the 13 common sense guidelines or best management practices, you have an automatic permit. There's no fee, and there's no inspection. So it's very simple to do. And to get those guidelines, you can just go to the gray water harvesting page of my website at harvestingrainwater.com, and I link to the New Mexico guidelines as well as the Arizona guidelines. And here's something I encourage New Mexico to do as well, is in Arizona, you're now paid to harvest your gray water. For anyone that installs a gray water harvesting system, you can qualify for up to a $1,200 tax credit. And I've got links to that on the website, and I encourage New Mexico to look at perhaps following the same path.
Now, let's go back also to the shovel. You want to install a gray water system. You figure out how to do it. You get a plumber. But then you need to make the right shapes in your yard by moving the dirt around. Do you have pictures, or how do you figure out how to do that?
Yeah. In my upcoming book, I've got a whole lot of information that clearly describes how to do it. But there's another book out currently by Art Ludwig called Create an Oasis with Gray Water. They can go to oasisdesign.net to get more information on that. And it clearly lays it all out and gives you choices for a number of different strategies depending on the unique situation at your house. But just the very basic idea is you're just creating a low mulched spot in your yard where you can use gravity to send the water right through your pipes into the soil. You mulch the surface of that soil, and then you plant it so the plants will then uptake and utilize that water. If you don't have the mulch and you don't have the plants, the system won't work because it's a living system. So you need the natural filters and pumps of the mulch and vegetation.
What kind of plants do you need to use, or can you use anything?
Well, you don't want to use any plants that really like acidic soil, because your gray water is going to be more alkaline because of the soaps and the pH of the city or well water. What I like to use is fruit trees, and you just use whatever fruit trees are typical in your area. I really like to have some evergreens, if possible, because they use the water year-round, whereas the deciduous trees will only be using it in the warmer, hotter months. And a key thing here is I don't use gray water on my vegetable gardens. I want to send it to perennial plantings, particularly food-producing fruit trees or nut trees. And I can place annuals around the base of the perennial plantings, but the perennials are the core, because I want the root system of those perennials to always be there, always filtering and pumping. Whereas, you know, with annuals like tomatoes on a trellis or flowers, they'll die out after the season, and then I don't have the roots. I have to reestablish them.
If you use gray water on your vegetable garden, is it going to taste? Are the vegetables going to taste like shampoo?
I've never found that. I've always found everything to taste great. But there's a key thing there. I make sure that I periodically leach the soils out. The soils that are receiving the gray water, I periodically leach them out with rainwater, which removes the salts. And the other key thing is, if, like with the tomatoes and whatnot, I make sure that they're on a trellis, so the tomato that I eat never comes in direct contact with the gray water. The roots of the plant do, but not the fruit itself. And that's just a key safety tip. Because here, there's chances that the bacteria in the gray water, you just don't want it on the actual food you're eating.
How do you see all of this rainwater harvesting working as we come into a period of accelerated climate change?
I see it as very important, because the rainwater, the gray water harvesting, all this does is it buffers extremes, and it looks like we are going to have more and more extremes with climate change. We will have longer, drier droughts, but then when we do get the rains, the rain will probably be much more intense than it has in the past. So by harvesting the rainwater, we reduce flooding, because we're starting to check and slow the flow of the water higher in the watershed, and we're also buffering drought, because we're holding on to that water longer, so we then shrink the period of drought.
How did you get into all this work in the first place?
Well, it was because of growing up in southern Arizona, in Tucson, and just seeing the ecosystem, the water resources being steadily depleted and things just getting worse over time. Well levels dropping, our rivers all died out. So I didn't want to be part of the problem. I wanted to be part of the solution. And I took a permaculture class, started to get involved with this, and then traveled around the world visiting different water harvesters and people pushing for sustainability. And it was then that I realized the potential that we really can be and live part of the solution rather than the problem. And so it became my goal and passion to enable and empower others to also live the solution.
And obviously, some people are not going to be able to do this work by themselves. I mean, you have a business. There are other people who have businesses implementing this for people and for businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I actually link on my website to a number of businesses in the Santa Fe area in northern New Mexico, and need to add still more. There's a growing body of folks that will do this work for you. And also, one of the reasons I wrote the books is so you can both educate yourself or anyone that you might have helping you out doing the work on your property.
Now, wildlife habitat is also part of your design.
Yeah, absolutely. The goal here is not just to improve things for people, but all life forms. And when I mentioned earlier that low water use native plantings are great for low water use landscapes because they've adapted to the local rainfall patterns. So if we want a low-maintenance landscape, they're the best. But the other great thing that they do is they grow more habitat, so we can enhance the ecosystem for the animals as well.
So even on your eighth of an acre in downtown Tucson, I mean, does that play a role?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's one thing that we did. We have a 20-foot public right-of-way. That's the strip of land between the property and the street where you usually have a sidewalk. And that's just barren when we moved here. So we organized an annual neighborhood tree planting project, which has planted over 1,000 trees in our neighborhood since 1996. And we planted 20 of those trees in our public right-of-way. And then they're all native trees in water harvesting earthworks. And then we did an understory of shrubs and flowering plants that are also native. And by doing so, we planted and grew, in a sense, an island of the Sonoran Desert ecosystem within the urban core. And when we started, there was only exotic pigeons. Now most of those have left, and we now have over 24 native bird species as residents and frequent visitors. So we're not just exposed to the plant life of the Sonoran Desert right outside our door, but also much of the wildlife.
So you'll be talking about all of this when you are in Santa Fe for the Bioneers Conference.
Absolutely.
And the Bioneers Conference starts on Friday, the 19th of October, and you will be there. Brad Lancaster, the website is harvestingrainwater.com. And will you link there to the details of your talk and the time and place and everything for when you're in Santa Fe?
Absolutely. Just go to the events page of the website and all will be there.
HarvestingRainwater.com is the website, and Brad Lancaster is the author of Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands. What's the name of your new book?
It's Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond, Volume 2.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce pianist David Geist. He is not only pianist, but impresario of the Geist Cabaret, which is in the cabaret room at Pranzo Restaurant here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Happy to be here again.
Now, we had you on not too long ago talking about the work you do, Broadway music, American traditional music, show music. you have something special coming up, which is a conference.
Absolutely. I'm very happy and very proud of what's happening. Santa Fe has been such a wonderful new place for me to bring my art to, and it's been so receptive to this Broadway music that I'm enjoying, having so much fun bringing here. And one of the things that I'm going to be doing very shortly is bringing some friends and colleagues from the New York City area who are these master cabaret instructors and performers, and we're going to do a very wonderful 3-day intensive cabaret workshop, which is going to go into great detail about the art form of cabaret and how to interpret songs on a very intimate level. And then we're going to have this wonderful showcase at the end of the 3 days, and it's going to culminate on that final Sunday, December 2nd, at Geist Cabaret at Pranzo, and all the participants are going to be in this wonderful showcase.
Now, is this for musicians, singers, dancers? Who's going to be taking part in it?
Well, it's primarily singers. I have been telling people that anybody who's really open to the art of song interpretation, whether you're a folk singer, Broadway singer, rock and roll, it's the art of real deep intimate song interpretation. It's you can trace the lineage back from the days of Edith Piaf and these wonderful the French cabaret singers. But cabaret in its more modern sense is really intimate song performing in a very small venue. And you can apply these principles, these techniques to any kind of singing, even opera, even classical musicians are encouraged to come and take part in it.
Have you seen in your, I mean, you've been doing this work now for decades. Have you seen young singers go from being talented to being, what would you call it, special in the sense of engaging the audience in that way that certain people have? And what does it take to do that?
Well, absolutely. It really, it is a muscle. I mean, people think, oh, either you're born with it or you're not. And I think talent and artistic inclination, it really does need to be cultivated and to be helped work through. And wonderful teachers have helped me understand my talents and the abilities that I have. So, yes, you can meet wonderfully talented people. And some people, for whatever reason, maybe it doesn't get to be brought out in them. I take great pride in being a teacher as well as a performer and finding people that I think, wow, there's a wonderful gift. There's all this potential. And to really, there are tools. There are particular methods. There's schools of thought. There's acting methods. There's tools that I've received.
What are some of those tools?
Well, part of my training is I studied with a wonderful pianist named Kenny Werner, who's a fabulous world-class jazz pianist.
He's played here in Santa Fe.
Absolutely. In fact, I think he's coming with Betty Buckley, who is a world-class cabaret performer, and I've had the great opportunity to work with Betty on many an occasion. So Kenny and I studied piano. I studied with him quite in depth, and one of the gifts that he really gave me was this whole idea of finding that effortless place within yourself and meeting your instrument, meeting your art, whatever that may be, whether you're a singer, even a painter, a dancer, a saxophone player, a pianist. There's this quality that we have that is very simple, it's very calm, and it's a pure part of our nature, and finding the place where that meets your art. And then from there, really honing in on it, really focusing in on that, and then doing just a little bit of your art at a time from that place. And then you've learned to have this relationship with your art that really stems from this core place of who you are. And then little by little, that starts to become, every time you do your art, you are approaching it from that wonderful place. And I take great pride that I've been one of Kenny's students, and I feel like I have been able to take on that lineage that he received, and it's been passed down to me, and I'd love to pass it to others.
Going to that effortless place seems like a sort of spiritual thing, if for lack of a better word. Are there also things that are more what you might call technical?
Absolutely. I mean, I try to, you know, I don't want to, you know, talk about any kind of, you know, new agey stuff about it. But, I mean, that was part of the training that I had. But, yes, with singers, obviously, you need to breathe very, very carefully. There's a particular method in which you breathe in sync with the phrasing of the music. There's certain acting exercises that these people will bring my friends and colleagues from New York, where you really do, you take apart a song, you really will get inside the poetry the poetry of the lyric from this very deep place. And then you use your active imagination, your memory recollection, and you find the experiences that you have, that you had, to relate to the poetry of this piece. And then you've really found your authentic connection to the text of the piece. And that's for your storytelling. So that's one aspect. And then for the physical, technical aspect of the singing, yes, there's certain technical exercises to really have your breathing be totally in sync with the phrasing of the music. And there really is an art form that where this whole thing just sort of breathes and opens, and you have these wonderful storytelling moments.
Well, some singers are also make it a lot more of a physical activity. I mean, I don't want to say it's quite dance, but it's on the way there.
Absolutely, you do. There's energy in the body, and there's energy in the experience that you're having. I know one of my musical mentors is Keith Jarrett. Have you ever seen Keith Jarrett do a piano concert? He goes crazy. I mean, he gyrates. He's all over the piano. I mean, the art, you know, the passion, the inspiration, it's moving through the body. So, yes, some people, you see singers, you see these wonderful divas, and their arms are moving. And, you know, it's like the energy is moving through their body. They need to sort of, you know, it's moving through them, and this is how they're expressing it. But, you know, everybody has their sort of different physical approach. And that will be part of the instruction is to really harness all that and to be really clear and to be very calm. When we're talking about cabaret, we are talking about performing in an intimate setting. It's not a rock and roll arena. You can apply these principles to your rock and roll gigs, you know, if that happens to be, you know, your preferred, you know, song choices. But you really do want to find that place first where the movements, the gestures are pretty economical at first before you start to, you know, add lots of broad strokes.
Do you remember when you were studying if there was a song that in which you really remember first finding that effortlessness and that expression and that flow for yourself?
That's actually a really good question. One of the first pieces that I brought into a piano lesson was with Kenny Werner. Was I did this wonderful piano solo version of a song by Stephen Sondheim. It was called Move On from Sunday in the Park with George. And the lyric spoke to me. It's about this artist that is in pursuit of inspiration. The artist is stuck, and he finds his inspiration from an ancestor. And that's how this whole song works how it functions into the fabric of this show. And that whole story spoke to me, so I created this wonderful piano solo arrangement of it, and I brought it to Kenny, and he said, "Oh, that sounds good." He goes, "It's really beautiful. It's really feeling. Come back next week and play it in all 12 keys." And I was like, "What?"
Oh my goodness!
Because I was very attached to certain the song is originally written in the key of B, whatever that might mean to some listeners. But I was very attached to these gorgeous harmonies in this key, and like, don't get too attached to just, you know, how things function in one key. So that was sort of the first experience I had. But yeah, that song was like the beginning of, I would say, my experience of music coming from an effortless place. And now I you know, I like to, that's my aspiration, is to have all my music arise out of that place. It doesn't always happen that way, but, you know, at least I've had those experiences that I can recall. Like, I know what that's like, and that's my goal.
The Santa Fe Cabaret Conference is on November 30th and December 1st and 2nd, and you've got some award-winning cabaret artists, Lena Koutrakos.
Correct.
And Rick Jensen. And you'll be there as well.
I will indeed. I will be observing and hosting. And these are wonderful friends and colleagues of mine. And they've gone all over the country and done these wonderful workshops. They were original instructors at the O'Neill Center Cabaret Conference. So they've done these conferences in various cities around the country, big, huge cities like New York, Chicago, Boston. And since I've moved to Santa Fe in the last 2 years, I've suggested there's a huge singers community here. There's a lot of passionate people I've met. I thought let's work on opening up this place to add to our, you know, to touring and to coming through, to really, you know, find people that really want to receive these teachings. And they were like, great, let's do it. So I'm feeling very happy about it. I'm somewhat of this liaison between what's going on with these people and bringing them here, and I have this wonderful base here, and I'm just really happy that people are very, very interested. We have some more openings available. We're about 2/3 of the way full, but we'd love to get some more people involved in this, and it's a fabulous opportunity. I really encourage anybody who's interested in the art of song interpretation, if you have any passion whatsoever for music, you will just really love this experience.
What is the number that they should call if they'd like to find out more?
Well, they should call me, David Geist, at Pronzo, and the number at Pronzo is 984-2645. Once again, call me, David Geist, and call Pronzo at 984-2645. 2645, and they'll put you in touch with me, and we'll take it from there.
David Geist, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like to welcome Deborah Potter. She's the author of the book, Let Buster Lead, Discovering Love, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and Self-Acceptance, published by Sunstone Press. She will be at Garcia Street Books on Friday, the 19th of October at 5 o'clock. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. How did you decide to write a book about your dog?
Well, I was in love with my dog. I think so many of us out there in Santa Fe and Taos and Albuquerque know what that feels like to be absolutely in love with your dog.
Not to mention the rest of planet Earth.
That's right. And he was diagnosed with an illness, and in order to keep myself from screaming and crying all day, because there was nothing I could do about the illness, it was the closest thing I could do to keep him alive, was to just try to write down every memory I had of him. And that's how the book started. It starts right there in the Santa Fe Animal Shelter when I first saw those beautiful brown eyes.
Now, this is a story also about you, because you had an accident. You fell off a horse, and the dog was part of your healing process.
He certainly was. But border collies, he's a border collie, and they're always looking for work. They're always looking for a job. Gotta have a job. And he was trying to do everything we could to please him. Gotta have a job. And I fell off my horse. I broke 5 bones. I was in the hospital for quite a while. A year and a half later, I developed a severe case of post-traumatic stress disorder.
From the fall?
From the 5 broken bones that I sustained, just being afraid, just terrified, like what most people are with PTSD. You become hyper-vigilant and just constantly afraid.
Now, isn't that funny that it developed a year later?
Usually it does. Since discovering I had the disease by accident, I am one of the very lucky people, Mary Charlotte, who had this disease and found out I had it. I almost ruined a fantastic life because I didn't know what the symptoms were. I didn't know that's what I had.
What were the symptoms that tipped you off?
Actually, when I read about them in a book, when I was trying to figure out how to keep Buster with me, how to make him my service dog, I was just kind of inadvertently trying to figure out, well, is there a law I could maybe ban, but I wouldn't do that. And I was reading the different diseases for which people have service dogs. People don't realize that often service dogs are essential to people with disabilities that aren't obvious, both mental and physical. Workingdogs.com is a really good resource for people to find out more about it. And I was reading the different diseases for which people have service dogs as a medical option. And when I came down to PTSD, my jaw dropped because those were the symptoms I had, which were. And I'm going to read, if you don't mind, just from my website, because I wrote them down. My website, letbusterlead.com, also has these listed, which is, you know, nightmares, flashbacks, constantly re-experiencing the event over and over in your mind. I could have done this. I should have done that. And if only. And I remember this. And how come I didn't do this? And all the time. And then persistent daily thoughts about the event. You're just too cautious all the time. You're just much more cautious than the average person or than you were before about things. Persistent memories of the event, which we've talked about, just emotional numbness. Just don't come near me. Just your boundaries, just emotional boundaries. My emotional boundaries became so thick that I just couldn't let anybody in there except my dog. And
not even your family members.
Oh, no. And trouble feeling affectionate was another one. I was just like, get away from me. Don't touch me. I don't want you near me. Easily startling. My husband would walk in a room. I'd scream. I'd be driving down the street in the passenger seat with my husband. A car would come in from another direction. I'd scream.
And that must have been so confusing since the event had happened a year earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're thinking, what's wrong with Deborah here?
Well, and irritability is another one. Aggression's another one. And depression, of course. And then when I started reading about PTSD and what the symptoms were, then I realized that that's what I had. And I was able to seek treatment. But I honestly didn't want my husband in the same room with me. I couldn't stand to have him in the house after a while. My husband isn't – there's so many people out there who know and love my husband, Earl Potter. He is the most wonderful, sweetest man on the planet. And I just couldn't stand having him around me. What I didn't realize was that I couldn't understand – I couldn't stand having anyone around me because I gradually stopped going out. When I look back, I realized for a year and a half we had not gone out to any social anything. I talked myself out of it every single time.
So how did you treat it? How did you go forward from there once you realized what was going on?
Well, first I realized it wasn't going to end overnight. That's a really important thing for any of us with any kind of disease or disability to realize we're not going to fix it overnight. I talked it over with my psychotherapist, and he asked me certain questions as to whether or not I felt the nightmares, all the lists we kind of went over. And then I went to a Rolfer who was a real expert in that. He had studied with David Levine, the leading expert on PTSD, and he encouraged me to read a couple books about it. And he told me more what the symptoms were, and that when your body starts letting go, when you feel like you're being well, that's when it crops up, because you're not hanging on to your body as much. Your body's finally saying, okay, you know, I can relax now. And then it's physiological, not psychological. It's like when your finger gets near a candle, a flame, you flinch. You automatically flinch. You don't say, oh, gee, that's hot. I better flinch now. Right. You know, it's just – and the same thing with PTSD. It's just a physiological, not psychological reaction.
And then you're able to, through different therapies, short-circuit that physiological reaction and get back to your normal self.
Yes, over time there are. EMDR is also a highly recommended therapy for this. There's another organization called Sidran Institute, and they're at sidran.com, and people can access that website to find out where they can get people certified or experienced, educated to treat PTSD in their communities.
Now, what was the role of your dog in this whole thing?
Well, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have been trying to figure out how to keep him near me and get him on airplanes and be able to take him out in public if it wasn't for him in the first place. And then he was the one who got me out. He got me going out. He kept saying, you know, come on, let's go out. And I felt he did become my official service dog. In the book you see, we went to an official trainer and he became certified. And that you don't really certify them, but he got his little ID card and his jacket and all the good stuff and his uniform, and he finally had a job. He finally had that job he always wanted. And he would be with me. He would stand behind me at a counter in a store. Counters and stores are always arranged so that the entire store walks behind you, and you can't see people. And I was just terrified of that. He would stand behind me and tug on my leash when somebody was coming closer. He also was the one eager to say, you know, let's go out. Let's go out and do something today. What are we going to do? Can I come? And often there were situations I didn't want to take him with me, like to a dark theater or something, because I was afraid people would step on him. And so my husband would sort of cloak himself around me, and we'd go out, and then we'd come home, and Buster would say, why didn't you take me with me? You should have taken him. You know, even it's, of course he didn't say that, but
his eyes
said that. That's right. You and I know he said that. But I felt absolutely safe when I was with him. I felt so protected when I was with him. And he would go through a door before me to check out the room, make sure it was safe. And then we'd go in. And just having him by my side also alerted people to the fact that there was something about me that allowed me to be different. We're all allowed to be different. We're all different in some ways. It's nothing to be ashamed of, but it was a real sign to people, this woman's different. Let her be different.
After your dog died, did you get another dog? I mean, I know that there are some dogs that just hold a special place in your life forever and are irreplaceable.
Buster is one of those people who held a special place in my life. And, yes, one of those people. He really was. You know, I had so many people, as you see, I'm sure, read in the book, that people said, you know, he's not a dog. He's a person. He's just he had his companion dogs, Reggie and Gracie, for many, many years, and they're still with us. Rex, the cat, has died. He just died a few weeks ago. It's very sad to lose him. But Gracie and Reggie are still with me. I have no need for a service dog because I did get well. Buster stayed alive until I knew I was well. Literally, he died a week later after I knew I was well. And I know he waited for me to know. I know he waited till his job was done.
The book is called Let Buster Lead, Discovering Love, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and Self-Acceptance by Deborah Potter. And she will be at Garcia Street Books on Friday, the 19th of October at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.